All right, guys, welcome back to another episode. Today we have Brian Barney on. I don't think he needs much of an introduction, but anyway, I'm super pumped to have a chance to chat with him. So how you doing this morning, man?
Yeah, all good. Yeah, got rolling. You just let me grab another cup of coffee, so plenty of caffeine for this morning. So yeah, doing good.
Right on, man. Well, I know you're a super busy guy, so I'm going to just jump right into it. I'm super curious about, you know, like how you got into hunting. I've listened to a lot of podcasts you've done in the past, but I don't recall ever hearing anything about, you know, if your dad hunted and that's how you started, or if you just kind of met a buddy or whatever. I'm interested there.
Yeah, so I was introduced to hunting as a kid. You could start hunting. I actually come from Washington State, is where I was born and raised. And so I was 10 years old when I started hunting. And, you know, my dad was, he went really hard. We were blacktails and Roosevelts. And my dad at the time had to be, well, let's see, he was in his 30s. He had me at a young age. And so he was like 30s, 40s as I was hunting with him as a kid. And he pushed us really hard. Like we would backpack into spots. We would just beat the brush. It was all day, every day. And I kind of fell in love with it. Like at first, it was a lot of hard work and things. And I had other things that I was interested in, girls and wrestling and things of that nature that I put a lot of effort in. But every year my family would go hunting. We'd had the extended buck, which was a 4-day season that we'd spend at the cabin. And then I'd go with my dad every weekend and we'd go hunt pretty hard. And so it planted the seed and I enjoyed it. I picked up a bow at like 15 years old. And I had worked for my dad all summer long building his house and got my first bow. And I was the first one in the family to start bow hunting. And I enjoyed that and saw some success and got lucky in and through there. But the whole time I was wrestling for state titles, I was running a lot of miles, I was putting everything in. And wrestling taught me like so many of these great life lessons, like the harder you work, the more you achieve. And so like I fell in love with it. But then after wrestling got over, completed, I was like looking for a place for my passion. And that's where I really poured it into bow hunting. So I moved to Montana at 19 and just immersed myself in the outdoors. And at that time, I would take any opportunity. I would rifle hunt, I would bow hunt, I would hunt bears, I would hunt horns, like anything to be out in the wild and go do it. And as I started to progress and started to improve and get better, like I started to use these same tools that I learned in wrestling. Like the more I put into it, the better I got, the more I achieved. And then started branching out from Montana and going on these wild adventures in different places. Yeah, I started finding success for mule deer and for elk and totally different states, different units. And I just fell in love. And the longer I did it, the more excited I would get for the upcoming season, the harder I would work, the more knowledge I would gain and started to find success and then started sharing it with guys and kind of took off from there. And then the outdoor industry, I've kind of just built it brick by brick. Nobody was going to sign me to a 5-year deal or a signing bonus or anything like that. Like all the first work was done for free. All my writing was done for free until I could get a pro staff position. Podcasts were free until I could monetize it. Filming was for free. My first 10 films until I could get to a point where I knew my value and knew my worth. And now, you know, I have a career in the outdoor industry after 20 years of working at it. So that's kind of the cliff notes anyways.
Yeah, man, that's intense. You've definitely put a lot of work in. I've just noticed the success that you seem to have every year. And I know personally from my own experience that to have that success, in my opinion, it's like it has to be a lifestyle. Hunting doesn't just shut off and then turn back on during the fall. I feel like my personal success has came from working on it all year long, whether that's fitness, e-scouting, looking for tags, you know, draw odds, all that stuff, shooting my bow, building arrows, building, you know, shooting my rifle, e-scouting, all that stuff. So it's like it's never ending, in my opinion, if you want to consistently notch tags. And I've noticed like you on these crazy trail runs and a foot of snow and all this stuff on social. So, but I got to say, I had no idea you were from Washington. I thought you were like a Montana guy your whole life. So let me ask you, where were you born in Washington? Where did you grow up at?
Yeah, I'm a coastie. Come from
Really?
logger genetics, you know.
Same
So,
here, dude.
yeah, I grew up in well, just outside of Olympia, Washington. Like Tumwater was the high school I went to, and yeah, grew up there for 19 years.
That's crazy. I live 20 minutes from Tumwater.
That is crazy.
You ever heard of a little town called Tenino?
Oh yeah, for sure.
That's where I'm at.
Right
so,
on, man.
Man, I had no idea you were from Washington. That's really cool.
Yep, for sure. Yeah, and it's the reason I think you've seen so much success like that. What you just stated, the year-round pursuit, the lifestyle, I think that's the key to success, especially for us public land do-it-yourself guys. Like, we have to work at these different skill sets and facets that go into being a complete hunter. And when you work on it year-round, like that starts to add up in the end, and then we start to see success. So, yeah, same to you, man. You've seen some incredible success, and just due to your hard work and commitment, for sure.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, it definitely took me a lot of years to figure that out. So I didn't grow up in a hunting family. We were definitely an outdoors family. My dad did a ton of salmon and steelhead fishing, you know, living out here in Washington on the coast. We have more rivers than you know what to do with, but I could go down a rabbit hole about the fisheries nowadays. They're not what they used to be. But anyway, I didn't start hunting until I joined the construction industry when I was 18, played a little bit of college ball, dropped out of school. School wasn't really my thing at that point. Went right to work. And I met a guy named Stan Rutherford, who was our loader operator on our pipe crew. And he kind of took me under his wing, took me out blacktail deer hunting at 18. And from like day one, you know, him taking me out, I was hooked. And but my first years, you know, the first 10 years I started out, I was pretty much just like a weekend warrior. Chasing elk during the late season with my bow, and then chasing blacktails during like late buck and that October timeframe. But I really wasn't putting in the work, you know, the time. I was killing animals, but I was kind of shooting the first legal animal I found at that point. And then, you know, this whole YouTube thing started, you know, me finding YouTube just in general. And I was watching guys like the Born and Raised guys and guys like you and Brian and Ryan, and the list goes on and on and on. But I saw all these crazy adventures out of state. And for me, before I saw that stuff, it felt like it was like out of reach. It was overwhelming to figure out like how to get a tag and where to apply and how much money it costs. And then Go Hunt comes along and makes it like so easy that anybody can do it. And I started applying out of state and building points and going to Idaho every year. And from that point on, it's kind of when the light bulb, you know, turned on, like, man, if I want to be successful on these hunts, I got to put in the work all year. You know, I got to work out and do all that stuff. And I've seen a huge change in my, you know, my whole experience due to that. So just super grateful. That's for sure.
Yeah, you nailed it. Well, and hunting these different species in different environments improves your skill sets in different ways. You know, it makes you a more complete hunter. And really, you know, there's all these facets or all these things we work at to be a better hunter, but king is experience. Like, the more places we can go, the more we can hunt, the more days we can put under our belt, that's where we really learn. And that's where we take that knowledge that we've gained or these theories that we've heard, and we apply them to our own hunting and we build our own style of hunting. But yeah, once you start to stack up the hard work, the experience, the different places, you start getting pretty confident in your skill set that you show up to the trailhead and you're undeniable. Like, there is a, you know, I am going to arrow a big buck, or I am going to arrow a big bull, and it's not these hard to draw units, or, you know, most of the places I'm hunting are general or over the counter tags or 1 to 3 point units. Like, you realize how tough it is to win the lottery when you start applying out of state. It's that I can't even draw a 1 in 300 tag or a 1 in 100 tag, or sometimes even a 5% or 10% draw. It is really tough to get a tag in. So you just got to get really good at the skills that go into being a complete hunter, and you start seeing the success just like you have.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. So I am curious, before we jump into your 2024 season, I'm pretty sure you're a contractor as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I've owner operator at Barney Construction. We started in 2001, so we're coming up on 25 years.
And so obviously construction is like a widely used, you know, term, I guess. So there's guys, you know, underground utilities, house building. Like, what are you doing? Are you building houses? I'm pretty sure.
Yep. Yep. Residential houses. Yep. General contracting, but really we do the majority of work ourselves, from concrete to framing, siding, roofing. We do the finish work, wood floors, tile work. We do a lot of it ourselves, cabinets, trim, pretty much start to finish. But yeah, it's been a good living, and been able to support my family and support my habits of bow hunting for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I was curious how you get so much time on the mountain. And I think that kind of, it's kind of not obvious, but you're being the owner, I'm sure you've all these years of dedication and hard work you put into building your business. You probably have some pretty good guys you can lean on when you want to step away to keep things rolling.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like when you first start your business, you realize that you get less time, not more, because you're responsible for everything. But after doing this for a while, like, bow hunting means so much to me that I put the right guys in place to be able to cover for me when I'm gone. I'm real upfront with my owners, letting them know I'll be gone. There's still progress happening on your project. And then just work really hard to make sure that I'm doing everything on my end, that I get it all taken care of before I have to leave. But yeah, it definitely helps with getting free time on the mountain.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I want to say is when I joined the construction industry, I joined the laborers union out of Tacoma, and started out as just like a general laborer at the bottom of the totem pole. And then, you know, as my career's gone on, I just have slowly been able to work my way up now into the office as a project manager estimator. So now I'm on salary and I get paid when I'm gone, which makes it so much easier to take these extended periods off of work and, you know, make sure the bills are still being paid and the wife is happy and all that stuff. So, yeah, man, it just comes down to how bad do you want it, I guess, right? And everything in life, how much are you willing to do to get there? And yeah, that's really cool that you got your own business.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, man, nailed it. Yeah, how bad do you want it? If it's really important to you, you make it happen.
Yeah, my brother was working with us as a foreman, and he ended up starting his own business 3 years ago. And it's really cool to see him. He's been super successful his first 3 years. And last September, he spent like 25 days in the woods straight chasing bulls. So I was like, dang, man, super proud of you. He's my little brother. It's really cool to see him do that. So
good for him. He's got his priorities straight.
He does. He does. All right, man, enough about that stuff. So I'm sure a lot of people saw you had a hell of a year on the mountain. I would love to hear about your first trip of the year and, you know, where that was, obviously not unit specific. And how that all unfolded.
Yeah, for sure. So, man, it seems like my seasons are getting pretty extended now. So I have some good buddies in Hawaii. And so I kind of started off the season going out there and hunting with my buddies. They make it real easy for me where I can grab a flight, and then they got a house to stay, rigs to use. And so we went out there, hunted axis deer, hunted mouflon sheep, which is super fun. They're a real switched on species, great bow hunt. And able to arrow one of my better bucks to date as far as axis, which eat really good. So that was fun. And then we traveled to a different island and hunted mouflon sheep. I've fallen in love with hunting these. Like, we don't get many sheep opportunities as a blue collar bow hunter. Like, I apply all over. I've just never drawn a tag. But these mouflon sheep, they've adapted perfectly to the landscape of this super gnarly lava rock canyons. It's really dry and really hot on this island that we're hunting. And then you have nearly the whole island. And it's a public hunt where, the covering miles, walking down to the ocean, losing a bunch of elevation, just kind of finding these places where these rams refuge. And then their eyesight is better than antelope, better than anything I've ever hunted. They see you holding still. They pick you out. You just think about looking over the edge and they see you. So they're a real challenging critter and species. And I ended up harvesting one like the last morning of the last day, killed a really nice ram. And so kind of started off there with that trip, kind of like late summer would be the first trip of the year.
Right on, man. Yeah. I've never hunted on an island. I can only imagine the heat in, was that like August or what time frame is
that?
Yeah,
I think it was August. Yeah. The heat and humidity is a game changer. And so I do a lot of heat training running in the hottest part of the day. I have a steamer that I use constantly. And so, yeah, I get my body ready for it. And really there's been, people that have died. I'm not sure about hunters, but people that die out in that heat and that humidity out there. And so you really have to keep tabs on your body, get to the shade and, Yeah, that's one of the biggest challenges out there is dealing with that heat. And then, you know, I don't need much water. Like if I go running and it's less than 10 or 12 miles, I don't even bring water with me. So I just don't need much throughout the day, just the way my body's kind of set up. And so if I'm hunting, you know, the mountains for a day, I might bring 32 ounces of water, maybe 50 ounces of water for the day if I'm hunting. And out in Hawaii, I brought that, and you about die if you bring that much. Like you really, you start out at 100 ounces and you add a bottle every single day. So towards the end of the hunt, you're bringing 150 ounces of water for a day of hunting out there because you sweat out and lose so much.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I'm quite the opposite with the water. It could be October in Idaho and I've still got 100 ounces in my pack. I guzzle the water down. So some of those like early season bow hunts, man, my pack's heavy just packing water in. It's a game changer for sure.
Yeah, we're all kind of built different and different advantages and disadvantages. And yeah, we kind of got to just play the hand we're dealt. And so, you know, you need to keep into water. And so, yeah, you just got to be a touch stronger to be able to pack that weight in water. But yeah, it's a really good hunt with good friends, had a blast. Traveled back. It's a great warm up for season. And then, yeah, I didn't draw any August mule deer tags this year. So I was able to put some focus into, antelope, which, I've got a streak going on antelope. I'm not sure how many years in a row. I think it's like since 2006. I think I'm coming up on 20 years in a row harvesting an antelope spot and stock with my bow. So I definitely love to hunt them, but a lot of times I'm just trying to fit it in between hunts, or I've got a free day here or there. This year I was able to focus and take a tour across the state, take a week and really go target the larger antelope. We have good antelope where I'm at, but usually that's like a 70 to 75 incher is what I usually harvest. I have 176. And so I really set out this year to try to kill an 80 inch antelope. And it was pretty fun to tour across the state and then, yeah, able to harvest my best antelope to date. Just missed 80. It's like 79, I think, right in there. But a tremendous buck and a really fun stock where catch them in some wide open terrain and kind of just shadow him going over hills and staying in striking distance. And then he went over a big hill and I was able to kind of race over the top and catch him in bow range and stick a perfect arrow in him. And that was my best antelope to date, which was pretty cool stuff. It was a solo hunt, no cameraman. And I like hunting with buddies, but there's something special about a solo rip as well. And so yeah, that was a great way to start off season. I think that was like August 15th for opener right there. So had a lot of fun doing that.
Yeah. I want to touch on that solo part. So, I would say it's probably not my like strong suit being solo on the mountain for several days, but I have done a couple solo rips and I've said this before on the podcast, but it always comes to mind. I did a Nevada deer hunt. Like I think it's been 2 years now. I went over there for 10 days solo and had a heck of a trip. I didn't punch my tag, but I had plenty of chances, just made a bunch of mistakes on stalks and bedded animals and blew them out, thought they moved, blah, 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 all that stuff. But I guess the point of that is I stayed the whole trip 10 days and I didn't give up on it. You know, I had plenty of excuses to go home early, you know, struggling out there. And that hunt sticks in my mind, even though I didn't punch my tag, just the fact that I, you know, drove 14 hours by myself, hiked in several miles by myself, stayed on the hill, didn't make any, you know, excuses to come home early. I'm super proud of that trip. So yeah, the solos ones definitely hit a little different.
Yeah, you should be proud, man. Those mule deer with the bow just don't come easy. Like a lot of times mule deer is the toughest species I hunt, especially those older, more mature ones. And so, you know, like the longer we do this or the longer I do it, I'll say, is I really try to enjoy the experience, the adventure of it. You know, I am driven for success and that is the goal, but a lot of my most memorable hunts are ones that I was unsuccessful on where I got chances and I got into action and it just doesn't always come together, but we're also always growing, always learning. And if we define success by a dead animal, it's like there's going to be a lot of time and a lot of days in the field where you're unhappy. And so, like, I just try to enjoy my time away. You know, it's like I have time off work. I have that covered. My family's covering the household for me. And so I know I've got these days to go chase my dreams and my passion. And so, yeah, it's pretty memorable. And to do all that solo, I think you learn a lot about yourself when 10 days solo. And mine was a bit easier for this antelope. This is a truck camping, like traveling across the state. It's a pretty easy solo hunt as far as solo hunts go. Not nearly as tough as like your Nevada hunt.
Yeah, well, hey, I mean, being solo alone, whether it's at a truck camper bombed in somewhere 20 miles, it's still, you're still solo. You know, you have a lot of time to think, a lot of time for your mind to wander. And yeah, I mean, there's something about that trip. I didn't fill my tag, but I saw a ton of deer. So the fact that I was able to, you know, go to a new state, somewhere I'd never been before, find the bucks of the caliber I would have been more than happy to put my tag on. I slipped in, my stocks went the way I wanted them to go. But like, I'll give you one quick story. So it's like day 7, glass 3 bucks, first light, right? Like just light enough to see, put them to bed. They bed in this little thick, patch of like willows, or I'm not even sure what these trees are called, but they look like willows to me. Everything else is wide open, right? So this little patch of thick willows is pretty easy to keep tabs on. Drop a pin, make this big loop around. It's by then it's like, you know, late morning, wind's going up the drainage, got the wind perfect. I drop down, I sit, I start glassing, and I pick up 2 of the 3 bucks like right away. Around 10 o'clock or so, they get up and they get out of those willows and they just feed like straight away from me and go to their second bedding area, which was out of my sight. Well, that third buck, I never saw him. So I'm sitting there, like I'm pretty sure I know right where he's bedded. But after 3 or 4 hours going by, like not seeing him, I start telling myself in my mind that he must have slipped out with those other 2 bucks and I just didn't see him. So I'm going like back and forth in my head, like, no, he's probably still there. And then like 20 minutes later, no, he must have slipped out. So I end up getting up and I walk like 20 yards further down this drainage. And he pops up. He was bedded 40 yards from me the whole time and takes off running. I'm like, oh my God. So I learned a tough lesson there. Like if you don't see him slip out, he's probably still there. But it was still an awesome experience.
Yeah. Those mule deer, they'll make a fool out of you and they'll also break your heart. They are just a really tough species to kill with a bow and arrow, and everything has to go right and go perfect. And it sounds like you were 95% there. You know, you just didn't trust your gut, and your head will play tricks on you as well. You know, and the only reason I'm any good at hunting mule deer is I've made every mistake in the book. So I've definitely made that mistake before and thinking he's gone and have him be right there underneath me inside bow range, just bedded tight. So yeah, they'll definitely break your heart and make you feel like a fool, but that's how we get better and improve. But yeah, it sounds like an awesome hunt. Yeah, there.
Yeah, it was a killer trip. Saw tons of bucks. One thing that stings about that one the most is I picked up that tag as a return tag. So I didn't really have any business drawing it. I only had one point. Now it's a low point area, so it wasn't like a premier tag, but now that I keep applying for it, I can't draw it. So it's like that one opportunity I had is like, it feels like it's out of reach again already. You know, it's so hard to draw these dang tags.
Yeah, it is getting tougher and tougher for sure. I've had a good run in Nevada. They've given me quite a few tags over the years, and I am aggressive with my applications, but I seem to have pretty good luck there. So I didn't draw it last year, drew it the year before, but yeah, it's I like going there for sure. I like their population and size, and I like hunting that more open desert landscape in and through there. So yeah, definitely have a deep love and connection with that Nevada country and taking some good bucks over the years. So yeah, I love it, man. That I finished up my antelope, and then I did have a high country mule deer hunt, which was awesome. And this was in country that goes above 12,000 feet. And so that keeps me training really hard for altitude all year long. And then I just know how rough and rugged these mountains are and how much climbing I'm going to have to do and how many miles. So it's a huge motivation for my training. And I would say, for me, like I love hunting all species with my bow, and really September, there's nothing I'd rather do than chase elk, but mule deer are my favorite. And so this was a hunt I was really looking forward to. And this one took everything out of me. So we captured it. I had a cameraman with me. I was 11 days from doorstep to doorstep. I went down a handful of days early to scout and kind of covered country that way, looking for good bucks. And then, man, this hunt just threw everything at me. I had a really good 3x4 located. He had a sticker in each one of his palms of his front, and he was kind of my first choice buck. And I hunted him for 5 days in and through there, and finally came up and above him and had a chance at him in there. He was bedded looking away from me, which is the perfect scenario. So I kind of covered my mouth so my sound wouldn't go to him. And I said to my cameraman, "Hey, he's right below us. We're going to shoot him right here." And he said, "Where is he?" He whispered back to me. And we kind of had a tree in front of us. And when I looked back down, that buck was staring right up at us. So this has happened to me before. You know, you try to go silent, but there's some communication that has to happen between me and the cameraman. And he heard a whisper, whether it was me, whether it was the cameraman, whatever. He heard a whisper. So now he's staring right up at us. And we had like a 5-minute stare down where nobody moved a muscle. And finally, he starts to go and exit and starts walking to my left. Have a range on him. I'm able to draw back. He stops, looks up and at us, pull, shot breaks. He was like 56 yards. And as that arrow's in the air, that buck heard that bow go off and jumps the string and totally gets out of the way of that arrow. And that arrow hits behind his butt. And you can actually draw, like you can put a spot on his vitals where I want to hit. And then you can play it in slow-mo and hold like that one spot where that arrow is right in the middle of his vitals. He exits, gets a couple steps, and that arrow hits exactly in that spot. And
oh my God,
that took me to a low of a hunt. It was like 5 days of pushing and grinding so hard to get an opportunity at that number one buck and then to get out of the way of my arrow. Man, I was just defeated, you know, but I've been there before. I've definitely missed before, and I've had bucks get out of the way, and there's like nothing you can do. I've been dreaming about this hunt all year long. And so it's like, pick yourself back up and get back after it. But man, what an adventure down in that country.
Yeah, man, that's insane. So up over 12,000 feet, I want to ask you real quick, not to jump off topic, but as far as your fitness goes, I got to admit, and I'm not trying to make excuses, but the last about month, I've been struggling to stay consistent with my normal fitness routine. I got two kids in sports. I work in construction. I'm up early. I'm gone, you know, home super late, going to baseball practice, soccer practice, helping coach and all that stuff. So like, I'm finding it hard to find the time to get some fitness in. Are you grinding like every day on that, or a couple times a week, or how are you keeping yourself motivated to get up early enough to get all that training in before work and all that stuff?
Man, it's so challenging, isn't it? Trying to manage a family and work and provide, you know, it's just something that's so important to me and that I've built in like the last 20 years is like the only reason I succeed is because of my work ethic and what I put into it. And so, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, like I'll have periods where I'm training really hard. And then, you know, like today I've got, you know, a couple podcasts. I've got to get to the job site. My daughter has a softball game. Like it might not happen today. You know, it's just the way it is. But I consistency is the one thing where I get gains. And so I'm like an everyday runner, a trail run a bunch. And yeah, I don't know how exactly I fit it in. It's just important to me, and I just find the time. And I think as busy as we all are, if you look at that screen time, there is definitely minutes and hours that go by where we're not productive in the morning, or you know, in after work in the evening, or when it gets dark. Like a lot of times, I'm throwing on my headlamp when everybody goes to bed. I just know that I'm building this fitness. I'm also building layers of mental toughness, and I've seen it help me be successful year after year. So it's really, really important to me. So, you know, right now I'm not at full scale training, and motivation is a tough thing, is to continue to find motivation. So I'll kind of grasp onto something like this early season high country hunt where I know I'm above 12.5. I know how difficult it's going to be. And it took 11 days to kill a buck in there. And so that kind of keeps me getting up day in, day out and getting in these workouts. Even if I can't fit in a big workout, I'm doing push-ups, I'm doing pull-ups, I'm jump roping. moving. I'm getting my heart rate up. Even if I only have 10 or 15 minutes at night, I just like find a way to get it in. It's also like longevity. As I put age on me, I'm starting to get older and I want to be in my prime and hunt these wild places for as long as I can. So it's just something that I put a lot of importance in, and I don't know how exactly I fit it in, but you know, it's pretty much 6 to 7 days a week, and it's not insane. Like, I'd love to be running 3 hours a day to get a workout. You know, some days I can only fit in a 20 minute after work, or I'll go on my lunch break and have to be back in 30 minutes, or I just kind of find a way to get it in because I know that it's going to pay dividends come season. And so this discipline that I build in pays dividends, like during season. The physical fitness I put in pays dividends, and also the mental toughness I gain by lacing up my shoes and getting it done day in, day out. So I've definitely fallen off at times. Like, I haven't tweaked my back for, gosh, it's been about 5 years. As you build these layers of strength, like my back holds up better, doesn't pull out of place. But I did a fly fishing trip to the flats where I was wading around doing multiple miles every single day. I was a little sore, and then, you know, 20 hours of plane rides home. And then I got home and I was running out in a foot of snow, and I just tweaked it a little bit. And I finally had to take, like, it was a good week and a half off where I didn't do anything. I was focused on recovery. So it's not like I don't fall off either or don't give my body rest, but I really try to keep after it day in, day out.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, like the months of January and February, I was cruising strong, you know, 5 days a week. And then my son and my daughter's soccer and baseball started. And I was one of those guys, like, I get up early anyway, like 5 o'clock in the morning, leave, it's construction, right? We're on site early. So I had a hard time getting up before that and working out, because when I did in the past, I could tell like I was kind of just going through the motions half-assed in it, because I didn't have the energy to push myself that early in the morning. So I was more one of those guys that was working out after I put my kids to bed. But with this baseball and soccer stuff, it's staying super late, and like I'm up later than I want to be already. So, but I can feel like in my heart, I know that I know I'm letting myself down. Like, I know that I'm not going to be able to push myself as hard as I know I need to come fall. And it's already bugging me because I know I'm not where I want to be. And, I guess I just got to figure out a way to squeeze some more of that stuff in. And, it sounds like you do a lot of running, which is what I kind of lean on as well. Not that I can run, you know, super far or whatever, but I personally feel like I'm in my best mountain shape when I can walk out of the front door and make a 5 or 6 mile loop, no problem. When it's time to put that pack on and go hiking, it's just so much easier when you have the legs and the lungs built up and you're ready for that, you know? So I got to figure out a way to get some more of that stuff in when during these kids' sporting activities.
Yeah, well, legs and lungs kill bucks and bulls, that's for sure. But the deal is we have to find balance in our life. It does no good if you're in good shape and you're not there for your family, end up getting divorced, or you miss some of these kids' sporting events. So, you know, you just have to make adjustments and find balance. Your family is super important. Your work is super important. And you're also getting fitness from being on the construction site day in, day out. It's not like you're sitting at a desk. And so, you know, you're moving throughout the day, you're burning calories, you're getting a workout. So it's like, don't beat yourself up too much. Like, you've got to be there for your kids and for your family and find this balance. And right now, the age that you're in, you know, like of your kids, like, you've got to be there for them. So like, I would just like, it's super important to you to perform in the mountains, like to just be doing some squats during their games or doing some push-ups during their games. And yeah, you look like a weirdo over in the corner doing it, but you're gonna look like a weirdo with a great big buck come fall, I think.
Yeah. All right, let's get back on. I'm sorry, I got a little off topic there. But no, so worries. day five, you whisper to the cameraman. He whispers back, Buck picks you guys off. You miss. You still got 6 more days on that hunt. How did it go from there?
Yeah, so well, we had a couple bucks we'd shoot in there. So we had that buck, that big 3x4 with a couple stickers. And then we also had a buck we called Red that was a great big typical. And they were living on this hillside, And really, we spooked that buck that day shooting at him, and that buck really tightened up his program. He still lived on the same hill, but he was disappearing in the buck brush. And same thing with Red. They just like tightened up their program a bit. And so I kept trying to get stalks and get plays. Red, I about had one day. I snuck into 50 yards of his bed. And the direction they come out, usually he never showed up. 2 hours went by, 3 hours went by. Storm came in, wind started to get fickle, and so I backed out of there. He never showed up, and he had gone out the back door and kind of gone into the buck brush instead of coming out into the meadow grass. And so then I spent the whole night 120, 140 yards away from him, and I just couldn't make a play in this buck brush. This hillside was also shaded in the morning, so, you know, it's going to be like a west-facing slope that gets a lot of afternoon sunlight, so I tried to kind of cut them off where they'd be feeding in the morning and show up there at daybreak, and just a bunch of miles, bunch of elevation, plays on these bucks. I just couldn't get them killed, and I didn't really spook them too much other than that missed shot at that big sticker buck, but they just were living in the buck brush, and eventually, like, I had to make this tough decision. It's like, okay, I got 2 days left. Do I keep hunting these shooters that are really hard to find, that I know where they're at, or are they just going to keep in the buck brush, and I've got to relocate my camp, I've got to move everything, and go find a buck I can kill, like, that's in good terrain and good topography. So that's what I ended up doing. I ended up hunting those bucks for a couple, 2-3 more days. I was down to my last couple days, pretty much, you know, day 8, day 9, tried to cut them off in the morning, didn't work. Like, I cut off all the bucks, and the shooters weren't there. So there's some nice 3 points, decent 4 points, but just not those big ones I'm after. And so, yeah, I loaded up my camp, and we moved and relocated. And we went after, I'd seen a great big buck in this basin that was living way up, like around 13,000 feet. And so that's kind of where I was headed. And there was like a few different drainages to look at along the way or from where we were going to camp. And showed up there, had to make a big climb where we were going to camp, pack all our water up there. And started glassing around, and happened to turn up like a really good buck. He was a big three, and I had passed quite a few 3 points on this hunt, but this one was on another level. He was like a big old deer that's going to be 8, 9, 10 years old, like heavy bladed tines, really long tine buck, where it was like, yeah, man, this thing's a shooter for me. This is what I came here for, is a big mature mule deer, and this one fits the bill. And he was bedded, gosh, about, I don't know, 12-4, 12-5, the tallest group of trees surrounded by cliffs. And yeah, able to make a play on this buck and get above him, had good thermals, and then just wait in that sun for 2 hours. And I could see his velvet down below. I could actually see there was 2 bucks bedded there, and I could see the other buck's velvet, and I was 50 yards away, positioned perfectly. So me and my cameraman just sat and waited. And man, that the smaller of the two bucks got up and kind of worked into us to about 20 yards or so, and he kind of picked off my cameraman where he was staring at him. And then the big buck that I wanted to shoot came out of the brush, and he was 30 yards broadside. And I'm so committed to these films and things, like, I could have shot him there, but we didn't have the cameraman on him. And so a few minutes standby went down here, and he's 30 yards broadside, and finally cameraman's able to get the camera kind of right behind my head, just get the buck, and he just says got him as I draw back, and then able to put a perfect arrow into this buck and hit him and like shut down his system immediately, and he kind of dropped and bedded right there. I thought, gosh, he's done or whatever. And he kind of makes one last go and gets to his feet. And gosh, he bails, does a suicide jump off about a 300-foot cliff down through there. Oh. I could hear him rolling all the way down there. But at this point, like, I got the adventure I was after. And if I get down there and he's all busted up, so be it. Like, I got to hunt mule deer in the wildest place on planet Earth. I arrowed a mature buck. The meat's still going to be good. Like, it's going to be fine, you know? And so went down there, found my arrow, blood everywhere. It was a good lung shot on him. And went all the way around, found him. He had fallen and rolling over 300 foot down these cliffs, and his velvet was all scarred up, but his horns were so heavy that he didn't bust his horns. He actually busted his skull And so I was actually able to skull cap him with a knife, if you can believe that. His skull pieces of skulls. Like, I mean, he took a beating rolling down that hill. But yeah, able to arrow a buck above 12,000 feet, 11 days in, absolutely depleted everything I had and kill a mature buck. And it was, he went 174 as a 3-point and just gnarly mass and just an incredible deer. In fact, he's like right above me now. Like, I got him hung up here, able to cut off the velvet horns, get a new mule deer skull, attach him to that skull so it looks like he's a European mount, able to preserve the velvet as it is. So like tearing off his horns or whatever, like some of the points are showing through, but made for like a really cool piece. And in that hunt, absolutely meant the world to me. So to arrow a high country buck like that in that country, to take everything I had, man, it's just absolutely amazing.
Man, you got me pumped up. I want to go grab my bow and start shooting some arrows in the pouring down rain. That's an awesome story.
Yeah,
that'd make a killer t-shirt too. That buck, the velvet hanging off of it. You should make something like that. That'd be really cool. But yeah, man, that's like a dream of mine. So inspiring to hear that story. I have not killed a velvet buck, and I've had a hard time not pursuing elk in September. And there's only a handful of states that let you hunt mule deer in the velvet in August, pretty much Nevada. So I don't know, one of these years I'm probably going to have to put the elk tag away and go try to get this done, because I would love to have one velvet buck on the wall. And man, that story just sounded like it was a blast.
Yeah. Well, you'll do it. You just got to keep after him. So that you got Nevada and Utah that are those early season hunts. And then I find the majority of bucks still hold their velvet. So, you know, I killed this one. The opening date was September 2nd. Now I'd scouted a few days before that. I can't remember the exact day I killed him, but it had to be September 8th or 9th. And his velvet was perfect shape before he rolled 300 foot down a cliff. But there are a lot of early September seasons as well. And I'm an elk hunter as well. Once it gets to be elk season, they're so thrilling to hunt. Like, I spend all of September, but I do find that those early September dates I can give up for hunting velvet high country mule deer, or even just velvet mule deer in general. So you'll get it figured out. You'll get your big velvet buck arrowed. You know, you just look for some opportunities around, and yeah, you might have to give up those first few days of September. But I really feel like the elk hunting doesn't really kick off until the 7th or the 9th, or even in my country in the mountains, it's like really it's the 12th to 15th before the rut actually gets going. And now I do miss some of that pre-rut action, but like my Montana season, I can hunt them into October and hunt a lot of that post-rut, a lot of that prime rut. So yeah, I'll usually give up those first few days in September to go chase muleys.
Yeah, I think I would do the same. The thing I struggle with is I usually have 2 or 3 weeks off work for that elk season. So it's pretty hard for me to go back to back on big trips like that. I usually have like, you know, 2 weeks off for elk and then back to work for 2 weeks and then 2 weeks off again and then back to work. And then, you know, I kind of have like these little, you know, hopscotch things going on. So one of these years I'm going to have to do it. But man, that sounds like a heck of a trip up over 12,000 feet. So I got to ask, like, do you have to get acclimated to that elevation? Do you stay down like a little bit lower for a day or so, or do you just rip right in?
Yeah. So altitude is real. And elevation is real. And so, yeah, I feel it, man. I live, my house sits at about 5,400 feet. So I get acclimated there. And then all summer when I know I'm doing this hunt, I'm running at 8,000 feet, 9,000 feet, 10,000 feet, just trying to get my body used to it. And then, yeah, it still takes a couple days to get used to that elevation and altitude. Man, it like puts such a wear on you. Like there's, you know, 400, 500 foot hills that I'd run up at home that there, it takes me a couple hours to make up and I have to take breaks. Like you don't get as much oxygen through your blood. And so your muscles fatigue quicker. They get on fire quicker. Man, you don't sleep as good, appetite suppressant. Like it is real trying to hunt high elevation. And so I train a lot prior to getting up there. I may even do like a couple overnights where I'm sleeping up at altitude. And then when I travel down there, I try to sleep as high up on the mountain as I can. So I know some passes that are 11, 12,000 feet that I have to drive over that I'll just stop and I'll camp there for the first night. And then it helped that I had 3-4 days of scouting before season started. And so I was hiking around around those mountains, getting acclimated before the season came. And it seems like about 5 days or so, I start to feel pretty normal in that country, or at least more normal than I do when I first show up. It's important to like watch your pace, to not push too hard, to recover, be drinking water, eating food, sleeping at high elevation, like all those things to help acclimate. But yeah, it's definitely in my hunt plan every year when I'm hunting that high altitude stuff.
Yeah, I know this year I was in Montana for archery elk, and I live at, you know, in Washington, still on the coast. So I'm at like, you know, 500 or not even five, probably 100 feet above sea level, and going in at 9,000 feet the first day hiking in, I was like, man, what is wrong with me? I'm like dragging ass like this. And I was training all year, so I was in plenty good enough shape to get up in there, but it was amazing how the elevation just kicks your butt. Like it's just taking like 10 steps and I'm like, man, I'm winded already. What is going on? And then, you know, the next day I was like back to normal. I was just cruising the timber, like no problem. So I have never been up over like 10,000 feet. So I definitely got Colorado in my future here soon. I've got quite a few points built up, and that's something that's been on my mind. Is I've watched some YouTube videos and seen some guys like that have ended up in the hospital from pushing it too hard and had fluid in their lungs and stuff like that. So yeah, I definitely was planning on heading out a few days early to kind of get myself acclimated. So it's, you know, interesting to hear you've done the same thing. And yeah, it's just, it's wild. It's wild how that works.
Yeah, it's not easy. I've seen that altitude sickness. Well, I've had it myself. I've had it on big trail runs that I've done, like above 10,000 feet. I got it on a big 50 miler. I got it chasing elk way back in the day above 10,000 feet, like just pushing really hard to try to catch up to this bull. And then I've had a couple buddies that have got it, that have like tried to keep with my pace going in the mountains and got altitude sickness. And yeah, I mean, you're throwing up all water, all food. You know, you eventually have to go to lower elevations to recover. So that can definitely hit hard. And man, I all have dizzy spells up there. Like, the elevation is real. It definitely takes, intentional, training for it. And then like, finding your pace in the mountains and then, getting acclimated to it is huge. But yeah, definitely added degree of difficulty. And this one, that's a really cool film. So it will come out on YouTube this summer. We just got the edit done. I just showed it at the South Dakota Bow Hunters Association, and then they just showed it at Mule Deer Days, which was put on by Mule Deer Fanatics. They premiered that film. Super proud at how it turned out. It's like a 28-minute film that captures all that high country action up and through there. So yeah, really proud at how that one turned out.
Yeah, I can't wait to see that one. So I got to ask a little bit about the filming. Did you do any self-filming kind of when you got started in this whole YouTube thing, or did you always have a camera guy come with you on your trips?
Yeah, I did a combination. So a lot of times Eastman's would pay for a cameraman, and we'd go, and that's my preferred method. So I can focus on bow hunting, they can focus on the film, and then I work in field producing it and making sure that I'm getting everything that we need to produce a good film. So kind of work together with the cameraman. But yeah, there's definitely been times where I've lost a cameraman, or we didn't kill him the first week and I went back. And so yeah, I've done quite a bit of self-filming over the years, and quite a bit of successful self-filming, do it yourself, public land with a bow and arrow, which is the highest degree of difficulty. But yeah, been able to capture some good kill sequences and put together some good films. Did a goat hunt that was a solo film. Well, I actually had a buddy with me that got the kill shot, but I filmed everything else leading up. And then I've got quite a few kill shots on film doing it myself. But man, it is so difficult. And you have to just be committed to the film above killing a deer, or otherwise what happens every single time is you end up shooting that deer off camera, or that bull off camera, which I've done that as well too quite a few times. But yeah, I have done a combination of self-filming and then with a cameraman.
Yeah, I do a lot of self-filming, and man, it's so hard to capture those kill shots by yourself. It's I love making the films, but not more than filling my tag. So when it comes to notching the tag, I miss so many kill shots due to that, but I'm hoping here soon that I'd be able to, you know, turn this into something where I can bring a camera guy with me on most of my hunts and help capture that stuff. Cause it just makes the film feel so much more full, and, you know, it's easier to watch, and people want to see that stuff, right? That's why they clicked on it. So I want to be able to provide that. And yeah, anyway, the whole camera thing adds a whole nother level of difficulty to the hunting trip. That's for sure.
Oh, 100%, man. Yeah, definitely ups the degree of difficulty. I don't know, twofold or threefold or what it is, but yeah, it makes it extremely difficult, especially like running and gunning for elk. You know, mule deer, I can kind of get into position and set up a tripod with the camera, wait for him to get up. That's like a little bit easier, but it's still high degree of difficulty messing with a camera and a tripod where you're trying to shoot a huge buck. So yeah, it's not easy for sure.
Yeah. Hey, one sec. I'm going to shut my door real quick.
Yeah, no worries.
All right, I'm back. My wife brought home a couple of rescue puppies, and they're going freaking crazy out in the living room. So there's going to be some background noise to deal with, but hopefully that's a little better. All right, so you got your mule deer tag punched. I know you knocked down a couple of bulls too, so I'd love to hear some of those elk hunting stories real quick to wrap this thing up.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, a couple bulls, and then I killed a great late season buck as well, which was really fun. But yeah, elk season is special to me. Love it. And so the goal this year was to kill one good bull. And yeah, I've killed enough bulls now where, you know, I'm looking for that herd bull. And, you know, he doesn't have to be a world record, but I really try to shoot for like around that 320 to 350 mark is like what I'm looking for. And depends on the hunt, the unit I'm hunting and things, but a really good solid 6 point. And so, yeah, I finished up that early season mule deer and right into elk hunting. Had a different state, different tag that I was going on, place I've hunted before and taken a couple nice bulls out of. And so, man, I mean, I loaded up in the pouring rain with my cameraman, and I was just so excited to get hunting elk and hear that first bugle that we went in the pouring rain. All the brush was wet, and you know about that from Washington. But yeah, it was kind of, I hate wearing rain pants when I'm hiking a bunch of miles, so normal pants, and man, we just got ourselves soaked. You know, usually I'll throw an extra pair of socks in, but I was saving weight. This is like a 3-4 day rip into this place. And so it's been really good to me. In fact, I killed a bull in there before at 3:31. And so I was really excited to get in there. So walked us in the dark, in the pouring rain for 4 or 5 hours of hiking through that stuff. Both of us were just so soaking wet, and snow and ice came in. We barely got in our tents, and I tried to get my sleeping bag with wet clothes to kind of dry them out. And it did not work. I like froze that night. It was really cold. And woke up in the morning, and the place was just a ghost town for elk. It's like they had been there maybe a week ago or so. Some old tracks, some old sign. I think I spotted some smaller satellite bulls, like a group of 2 or 3 of them, but just no groups of cows, no elk around. And so then you're faced with like, gosh, do I keep hiking back further? Do I come out and relocate? And so, you know, had to get a fire going, dry out everything, and just thinking about our next play. And so we moved to another spot. And the beautiful thing is, like, I've shared a lot of these places with my buddies. And so one of my buddies that I had hunted there with before, my buddy Dan Heverin, checked in with him, and he's like, hey, get over here. This one spot that we found is hot. You know, there's some elk in here, you know. And so I thought, oh, man, we got a place to go, you know. And so we packed up camp, backpacked out of there, and then met up with Dan, and he had been into him. And so this is a spot we had hunted before, and Dan really drew me a treasure map to this place. He's like, hey, I've been seeing this good bull way up this drainage, but he's really tough to kill up there. Like, I don't know how you're going to kill him. I just know he's up and in there. And he said, I tried for him the one day, and I ended up bailing out of there because I saw a bull lower. So I know I haven't spooked him, and he's up in that drainage. So, you know, why don't you go up this ridge? And so we had to hike quite a few miles to get in there, but Dan pretty much put me in the right spot. And so I got up there, and gosh, it's just getting into the afternoon, evening, and hear a bull bugle and start watching the cows and this bull pile out. And I was kind of stuck where I was, and he was a really good 6 point bull, one I wanted to shoot, just like Dan had told me. And so I just watched him come out, watched him bugle chasing cows, but I really couldn't make a move. And they went over the edge, and I saw him like early, like 4 in the afternoon or 4:30, like right when I got there. And they kind of fed over and fed into this spot. And so went to where they were, relocated them, heard them bugle. He had a pile of cows, like maybe 30, 35 cows. And they kind of got onto this open sagebrush face with some aspens in it. And we just started playing the game. We kind of take what they gave us, would move in a little bit closer, use this creek bottom to get in, had a good wind throughout, getting close, and just started playing the game. But the problem, I just couldn't get to the bull because of all the cows. And we just never gave our position. They never knew I was hunting them. And I played the game all night long for 3.5 hours with this bull. Finally made a big move around and cut him off and had him working right into me. And the cows working into me, and finally got a shot at like last light on that good 6-point bull. And put a solid arrow in him, and he ran over and tipped over, and just this great 6-point bull. And I think I'd only been hunting for like about 3 days for elk, and already I had a bull on the ground, and my one good bull of the season was done. And able to enjoy it, take a couple days to pack them out, or at least, you know, ran a trip out that night and then went back in the next morning and grabbed the rest of them. Oh, Dan met up with me that night. We were able to communicate through satellite messaging, and able to tell me I got one down. And so he showed up, took a load out with me. And able to kill a really nice bull. It just happened really quick. And it was like the first bull I got a chance at, and able to put a good arrow into him and down him. So, yeah, that's how my elk season started. Pretty good stuff.
Yeah, man, off with a bang. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. But I do want to pick your brain a little bit about your strategy. So, one thing I've noticed with, you know, guys like yourself and a few other guys out there on social, and I'm sure there's plenty of them out there that don't post anything on social, but it seems like those bigger age class bulls, guys like you are killing them without calling. The calls stay in the truck, and you guys do a lot of slipping in quietly. So the elk, and they don't even have a clue you're there. I struggle with, I love to call elk. It's so much fun, but, I end up shooting, you know, 5 points and smaller 6-point satellite bulls, which there's nothing wrong with that. I'm more than happy to put my tag on them, but I've found myself as of lately wanting to take that step into trying to kill mature bulls, you know, over 300 inch 6 points and things like that. So in your opinion, do you feel like your opportunities are higher to kill those upper age class bulls, leaving the calls behind? Or do you think it just kind of depends on the situation?
Yeah, I think your insight is spot on. Like the deal is like I'm able to target these larger age class herd bulls in and through there, the ones that are really tough to call in. And not that you can't call a large older age class bull in, but I'm hunting a lot of easy to draw high pressure units. And if a bull gets to 6 to 8 years old, 6 to 10 years old, he's heard the calls. He has his cow. Not that that bull won't call in, but boy, you sure got to catch him on the right day where he's fired up, or the right day where he doesn't have cows. And so, yeah, throughout the years, like I've just dedicated myself to this silent spot and stock hunting. And so, you know, I called in a lot of bulls in my early days, but what I found out is I was calling in a lot of the satellites, like you said. I was calling in the satellite fives, the satellite sixes, and so when I wanted to kill these giant herd bulls, like I had to change my tactics. And the other thing I found is like when these bulls come in, they come in on such pins and needles. So you may get the timing right. You may call in a big herd bull, but he comes in on pins and needles looking for any movement. He comes in forward facing, doesn't offer a shot, blows out, and that's like your chance. And I just found that if I kept the element of surprise and I shadowed these herds and I really worked at the skill set of like spot and stalking these elk, that I could target these older age class. And it's still super exciting, thrilling hunting. I don't know if it's quite as thrilling as bugling one in on a string that's coming in, bugling his head off. But I mean, there's nights where I'll hear 300 bugles and I'm making moves on bulls and I'm trying to cut them off and they're losing their mind and chasing off satellites and, you know, just sweat rolling down my brow and trying to do anything possible to arrow one of these bulls. So I've really found like a love for it. And yeah, I have to leave my calls in my truck because what I found is like, I would always go back to that. So I'd have a cow call or bugle. I'd try to spot and stalk. I'd run out of terrain, or I couldn't get close enough, or couldn't find the bull. It's like, well, let's just put out a couple calls and see if he's here. And a lot of times these bigger age class bulls, like what really changed my mind on it is I was hunting wilderness and I found this giant seven, like a dream bull. And I played everything right. He like went to his bed, and I got above him with a good wind. I slipped inside 200 yards, and I made a couple cow calls for him to come check me out. And he had heard enough calls in his life where he just gathered up his cows and got the heck out of there. So I'd been hiking all these miles to find a dream bull, and I got set up and made a couple calls and turned him the other direction. I was like, never again. I'm keeping the element of surprise. But it's something you have to work on, just like calling, of like taking what the elk will give you. And not every bull you find you can just crawl in on. Like a lot of times I have to sit motionless for an hour, 2 hours. Sometimes I lose a whole evening, a whole morning, and I just don't have a play. But the longer I can play the game, the longer I can keep the element of surprise, I end up killing a lot of these larger age class bulls. And so, yeah, you can see like on my feet, like the herd bulls that I kill are like these giant 6 points that we all dream about, because I'm able to specifically target them and get a good arrow into them.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to try to just leave my calls in the truck on a trip, because I tell myself as of lately, like, I'm going to call less. And then I get into the mountains 3 or 4 miles and I'm not seeing elk. And before I know it, I've got the bugle tube out and I'm starting to rip bugles to try to locate elk. And then once I get one to answer, you know, game on. And, you know, I've been able to knock down an elk with my bow several years in a row now. So, I mean, it's not like I'm not unhappy with that. I'm super happy to do that, but I want to take that next step and start knocking down some more mature animals. So I think I'm going to have to just leave them behind, because I know I don't have the self-control to leave them in my pack. So
yeah, it's tough, yeah, man. And kudos to you. Killing elk a few years in a row like that is no easy feat, especially when you're self-guided in public land. So yeah, you're definitely on the right step. And it's not that you won't ever call in a giant bull. It just seems like the odds are in your favor when you're spot and stalking them and stay silent for these older age class. At least that's what I found, and it works for me. But I think sometimes I miss opportunities as well, where I find a bull that's fired up middle of the day, and I won't call at him because I believe so wholeheartedly in my system of spot and stalking that sometimes I think I'm missing opportunities. I think the complete elk hunter, they could take all these tactics and use them when it fits, would be like the best elk hunter, that calls when a bull's fired up or responsive, that spot and stalks when you find a big herd bull that won't come in, that you can get in and cow call when a bull's looking for cows. And through perfecting my spot and stalk tactics on elk, I've kind of like committed to this style of hunting, and it works for me, don't get me wrong, but I do think that I'm missing opportunities by not having every tool in my toolbox, if that makes sense.
No, it totally does. It totally does. And it's just goes back to the point that you made earlier, though, is like, I've called in a lot of bulls, but out of all the bulls I've called in, I could only remember just a couple that have came in that were like the next level kind of bulls. It's always those satellite bulls, those little fives, little fours. They come in silent, or they come running right in. But those bigger bulls, they just don't seem to fall for that crap, man. So, yeah, you're probably right. You know, having every tool in your tool bag is always going to make you a better hunter. But it definitely seems like you're going to have a chance to kill those bigger animals if you're just slipping in silently. So I just got to learn that self-control. I love calling them so much that I just can't help myself when I start hearing a bugle. So I'm going to have to maybe just leave my calls in the car, because I know if I don't, I'm going to break them out. That's for sure.
Yeah, that makes sense. And all of that checks out. That is that is the move for sure. But yeah, it works really well. Once you can perfect those tactics, it's like, man, you start killing some really good bulls. And so I had killed that bull in another state. And again, my goal was just to kill one good bull. And so I did have another tag in my home state of Montana. And it was kind of like, well, I'm going to try to kill an absolute giant. If it's not a giant, if it's not something that that absolutely spikes my adrenaline, something that's a trophy bull, like, I'm just going to pass and I'm going to enjoy this next hunt. And yeah, I may not kill one. I already got a bull this season. Like, I'm good. And so I packed up stuff for 14 days of hunting. And this was going to be like a truck camping day hunting spot, even though, you know, I might backpack into some locations. I had a cameraman on this one as well. And so, yeah, we took off and I had a new spot. I had hunted this unit before, but I had a new area I had e-scouted. And I just thought, well, I'm going to go, we're running out of time tonight. I want to go into this new spot and go check it out. And so we hiked in there. It was a few mile hike to get in there and got in, set up on the vantage point, just nothing. It was crickets. And pretty soon that sun starts dipping and all of a sudden I hear a bugle and find these cows kind of squirting out of the timber. And it's great big 6 point. And it's a big shooter bull. It's a big 350 plus bull, which it's like, okay, that's what I came for. Like found my giant bull, first one I saw in here. So it was like everything I touched turned to gold this season. It just all worked out. But I make a play on this bull. I've got to circle all the way around him and get the wind right. And I relocate him again. I asked my cameraman, I'm like, do you think we got enough time to get to him? And he's like, no, no way. And I'm like, ah, oh, we're going anyways. And so we bailed off and made a play at him. And he just didn't show up where I needed him to. He was about 200 yards away, dark, like screaming his head off. I did run out of light. And so we just backed out of there and left him bugling. I thought, man, we got to play for the morning. Like, got a good bull located, love to kill that thing. And so hike back out in the dark, back in the morning super early, got in there before first light and nothing. I don't hear him bugling or anything. And lights kind of come on and I kind of grab some vantage points. And pretty soon I hear him and he's on the other slope. And so I dive in behind him, take chase. There's a few other bulls around, like it's going off in this drainage. And so I'm kind of chasing bulls. I passed a 7 and a 6 point that were satellite bulls. The 7 was like maybe a 300 bull or something like that, maybe a touch under. And then pass those couple bulls and I'm after this herd bull the whole time and I can hear him bugling. I know where he's at and I just keep making moves, but I never do get eyes on them. And they kind of disappear into this patch of timber that's like a sliver of timber, and it's getting late morning. He's not bugling as hard now. And so I kind of lay up on a vantage point where I can see the one side of this timber. And he'll still bugle every so often, but it's just thick in there. And I just know, like, chasing him into the bedroom, in their bedroom, is not high percentage for me. And so I kind of wait on the outskirts, and I catch this bull at about 1 o'clock, and he comes out on the edge of the timber, and he's got one cow, and he's kind of bugling and chasing this cow around on the edge of the timber. And it's like, well, now I know where he's at. And first off, I throw my glass up, and I go, well, that's not the giant 6 point from last night. And it was a 7-7, you know, which is so rare in the elk woods. And he's a great big 7-7. And it's like, oh my gosh, that's a different bull, but that's a shooter as well. It might even be bigger than that 6 I was chasing last night. And so I make a move on him and I actually get to like 30 yards on this bull and he's bedded right in front of me. I can see his antlers and he's got a cow bedded in front of him. And they don't know I'm there. I've got a great wind that day, like a 10 to 15 mile directional wind coming straight from the elk to me. And I just wait. And he gets up and the cow walks out at 30 yards broadside. And so I think the bull's going to do the same thing. And the cow kind of turns and gets back in the brush and the bull never comes out. He turns. I maybe could have got a shot if I was drawn back. He came through one shooting window, but I've just learned throughout the years, it's like not force arrows in there in the brush. And he bails like over this hill. I kind of take chase a little bit and start getting in there and start picking out cows. And I'm like, man, this is just too thick. I'm going to blow these things out of there. And so I just backed out 30, 40 yards from my dream bull and back out of that timber and just let them be and get to a vantage point. And, you know, my style of spot and stalk hunting, I like to kill them on their feet. And the evening is such a great time because they come out into these open parks and open meadows and I can make moves. So I set up in striking distance. He comes out in the evening. I make one loop around where I think he's going to go. He doesn't show up, kind of disappears from me. Get back on the vantage point as he's not bugling real hard yet. See him again, and he's gone up. Make another move back down and around, and he's just in the perfect place, and his cows are in front of him, and I slipped into I think I actually scooted back to shoot him. I think I was like about 55 yards or so, or I think I shot him at 57 maybe. And I could have got a little bit closer, but I actually had to scoot back to get the angle where he was feeding. No idea I was there and put a good arrow into him. And man, he bailed off, ran into some brush and kind of crashed. And so, you know, really, this is like where the hunt just started. I put a good arrow into that bull and super stoked, but just not quite sure where the arrow hit. Like the shot felt really good, but I'm not sure where the arrow hit or how I hit him. And so go up and I find my arrow and there's a bunch of blood and there's lung bubbles. And I'm thinking, I think I smoked him. Shot felt good. Like, man, I don't think this bull is going to go far. And so we give him the 45 minutes or so and trail him up and start trailing him up. And then I jump him out of his bed. And so that bull gets up out of his bed and goes, and there's just blood everywhere. It's coming out, entrance, exit, both sides, and just quarts, gallons of blood. It's like, man, I got him good, but he got up out of his bed. Where did that hit go? And the deal is it's really warm where I'm hunting elk there. And so it's going to get down to maybe 55 degrees that night, not cold enough to keep an elk. And yeah. I don't want to lose the meat. So I give them another 30 minutes and I have to make a tough decision. And I'm like, well, I think that was just his death run. Like, I think he's bleeding so good, he's not going to be able to make it that far. I think I got a solid hit. I don't know how he got out of his bed or why he got out of his bed, but I better get back on the trail. And so just start stalking this bull again through his blood trail and following him through there. And, you know, it gets a bit dicey where you start to worry, like, elk are the toughest animal on planet Earth. And they take a perfect shot, lungs, heart, or liver, and you get them. But if even on the edge of those vitals, sometimes you don't find that bull. Or if it doesn't hit the vitals, you got maybe a 10% chance to get that bull. And I still don't know where the arrow went. But there's lung bubbles in it. There's some dark blood there. Like, I think I got him good and take back up the trail and finally catch up to him. He'd gone about 300 yards, which was really surprising. And he was bed there hurt right at last light. And he wasn't going anywhere. He was going to die right there. But able to put another arrow in him. And that first arrow had just got a little bit low, a little bit back. Like, I think I caught a lung and caught the liver right there. So he was definitely hurt really bad. But not bad enough to die in that first bed 100 yards from where I shot him. He made it about another 300 yards. And sometimes, like, tracking these animals, like, you just have to rely upon your instincts to make the right decisions to be able to recover them. So able to recover all the meat. It's my best bull to date. It's a 7.7. Just a tremendous bull. And so, yeah, that's killed that thing on the second day. So I had a total in of 5 days of elk hunting and killed two giant bulls last year. It was like everything I touched just turned to gold. You know, it's like I had a grinder of a hunt on that early season deer and definitely a grinder of a hunt coming into the late season deer. So I paid for it after that, but just a tremendous bull.
Yeah, man, as you were talking, all I kept thinking was, you could just hear the years of experience kind of coming out of that story, the way you approached the hunt, the way you moved in on the animals, the way you even, you know, finished off the stock to recover the animal. You could tell that you've had a lot of years of experience on the mountain. And I'm sure a lot of that experience came with failures in the beginning, but, it's incredible, man. You had a heck of a year. I was also thinking about like how hard you grinded in the first part of the season on that mule deer, and then to knock down two giant bulls in just a handful of days is awesome. But again, I feel like you make your luck, and you've probably spent, you know, 30 freaking years chasing elk. So you kind of probably have a pretty good idea where you need to look to find bulls of that caliber. But, you know, all those years prior to this year, you know, has brought you to this point. So, man, I just, can't believe it. I've seen some of those pictures on social media and those bulls are freaking giant. So just want to say congratulations, man. That was an awesome story.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve. You can hear the experience in your voice when you can recognize. It's like you have to make 100 right decisions to kill a bull or to kill a buck. And it's never a given. They're always super difficult. But yeah, throughout the years making those mistakes, you hone those instincts to where now when I find one of those big bulls, I got a pretty good chance to run an arrow through them because I make pretty good decisions. And I believe in my process of killing these bulls, like backing out of your dream bull at 30 yards. It's pretty tough to do, but I believed he was going to come out in the open that night and I was going to get a chance at him. And it happened where in my younger years, I would have pushed hard through that thick cover. I would have blown out that bull and I never would have had a chance at him. And I would have had to start over and I would have had a grinder of an elk season. But instead, I made the right decision at the right time, which it's, you know, they're always kind of gray areas. It's not black and white, but I believed in my process and then able to run an arrow through that bull. And so, yeah, it's like so far I put together an absolute perfect season, and I've had some really good seasons, but this one was a dream hunt. And so my last hunt of the year was late season mule deer. Took me to two different states. I hunted over 20 days. We filmed a week of it, and man, it's like deep snow and big mountains and bitter cold, and just able to turn up some of these bucks of my dreams, the big hard horned heavies that are chasing does. And it's taken me some years in these units to really learn them. But eventually, like, we tried to film it for 5 days. I had some really close encounters on some next level bucks that I just couldn't get an arrow in, and ended up going back solo. And those are one of the chances where I could have completed a really good film if I would have filmed solo. But 20 days of hunting, like, I just wanted to arrow one of these good late season bucks. And I was able to find a good next level buck way back into one of these drainages, like the miles I'd have to put on to get back there. And mileage gets really tough in the snow. It's like twice the exertion on your body, but yeah, definitely double digit miles. And able to turn up a really good buck. He had an extra on him. Happened pretty quick. He was kind of like worn out from the rut, so it's late rut, and he was bedded by himself, and able to spot him bedded as I was making my way to the second vantage point, and see him right as I was making my play, got to his feet, and I was able to cut him off, and then I was able to get a good like 60-yard broadside on him and put down like one of my better late season bucks. They're really tough in the late season. But laced him, and then he had a good extra. He was like a 182, which was a tremendous buck. And so that closed out my season. I was able to take an early season mule deer, late season mule deer, antelope, couple dream bulls. It was like an absolute dream season.
Man, I don't even know what to say. That's I guess incredible for sure, but like, good, you're gonna have a heck of a time top in 2024, it sounds like. I mean, 180, 174 buck, couple 350 plus bulls, or three, whatever they were, giants. Yeah, man, that's just super, super cool to hear these stories. And yeah, I hope one day to kill just one 350 bull. That would be, I can only imagine the feeling on walking up on something like that. It's like a dinosaur, real life dinosaur. Yeah, unreal, man. Unreal.
Crazy. Yeah, the Australia, I've got some Australian friends, and they always tell me that I've got a fairy in my pocket because I'm so good at getting lucky, you know. And last year was definitely like good at getting lucky and capitalizing on opportunities. And, you know, you work on your skill set, and you're able to stack some pretty good seasons together. And so definitely it killed some good critters. But you're right, that'll be a really tough one to top. And so that's what keeps me grinding hard right now, is I know the feeling of accomplishment, and to be able to put everything into something and walk away with those kind of trophies is absolutely amazing. But I know that next season it will not be that easy. I may have to grind 20 days for a bull, or so, you know. That's what keeps me training hard, is like not resting on my laurels and resting on my work ethic and my skill set. And so, you know, it's running a bunch of arrows through that bow, being the best archer I can. Every successful hunt comes down to making a shot, and they're usually a high degree of difficulty, and especially like in the mountains and things. And so, yeah, man, it just keeps me working hard, because last season was a dream season, and might not kill that many quality animals in a season, but I know I'll have some chances at some pretty good critters in 2025, and definitely want to be at my best.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I want to finish this thing off with one more quick archery question. So yep. I've been thinking about switching to a hinge. My buddy Joseph shoots a hinge, and he's kind of got me just thinking about just the way the shot breaks with the hinge, right? You really can't force that. I shoot a thumb button currently, a stand, but you being a big time bow hunter, in my mind, there's some situations, especially when you're calling elk, you kind of have to be able to make that shot go off if you know how things just work out sometimes. What release are you shooting? I don't, like, is it a hinge, a thumb button, you know, the traditional release? What are you shooting?
Yeah, I shoot a thumb. So I shoot a Carter Too Simple. Okay. I learned the back tension style of shooting through shooting a tension release, waiting on the shot to break. And so it's a really quality execution that makes it so you don't have so many good and bad arrows. They're just like all in the middle. Makes you a real consistent shooter. There also isn't much difference between good and bad days. It's just like a real even keel way of shooting. It's really tough to transition your mind into waiting for that shot to break. It's tough on targets, and then it's really tough on animals. So it's taken some years to get there, but I execute a thumb like I do a tension release of pulling till the shot breaks. I never really taught myself how to cheat that release so much, even though I can cheat that release and make it go and punch it off. But I try to stay really disciplined, even at close ranges of executing that quality shot. But it's something that I have to think about all the time. It like doesn't come natural, but I'm always trying to execute my best shot. I shoot a hinge really well. And so I've thought about going to a hinge, but the thumb has just worked so good for me throughout the years. And I stay really disciplined on my shot. And so the thumb just works for me. The other thing I like are the advantage of a thumb. And there are some new hinges that you can clip to the string, but I love clipping my thumb release to the string. So what that allows is then I can range that animal and I don't have to take my eyes off that animal to look down at my release. Whether it's an index finger or hinge, you've got to loop it into that release. So you've got to look back down at your release, at your string loop, hook it back in, and then bring your eyes back up to the animal. And it just seems like that extra movement, they can catch you a lot, or catch you looking up or looking down or grabbing your release. So I do like that I can just reach down, grab my thumb, keep my eyes on the animal, pull, and then execute. But yeah, everybody's got to kind of figure out and find out what works best for them. But yeah, thumb works really well for me.
Yeah. Okay. That's good insight for sure. I like being able to manipulate that, the release, if I feel like I need to. Some of the bulls I've killed have ran into like 5 yards, you know, like frontal, and you only have like a split second to break the shot, you know? So I feel like it's good to be able to make the bow go off when you want it to go off, but obviously you want to try to execute a surprise release if you can. There's just some situations I've been in where I feel like if I didn't have that release, I might have not got an arrow off before the animal spun and took off. So anyway, well, I've had you on for like an hour and a half, man. I know you're a super busy guy. Can't thank you enough for coming on.
Oh, my pleasure, man. Yeah, it's good to connect with you for sure. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, let's stay in touch. I'd love to do this again maybe next year after your 2025 season and catch up on how things went for you.
Yeah, likewise. Let's get you on Elevated. Let's have a conversation on there. So yeah, we'll do it. Thanks a bunch, Steve. Appreciate you, man.
Yeah, man. You have a good rest of your day.
You too.